This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Dan Hurley. Memorials for Senator John McCain this weekend will not only look backwards at his long career, but serve as commentaries on our present situation. President Trump says a new NAFTA deal has to be done by tomorrow. What are the chances? Who has the leverage? We are joined today by the political junkie, Ken Rudin, and WVXU politics reporter, Howard Wilkinson. Ken, welcome, and I presume you have a trivia question that's worthy of our listeners and Howard's encyclopedic knowledge.
Yeah, let's see.
Well, hi, Dan. Hi, Howard. And yes, you know something? I realize that every week or every time we're on the show, we do an Ohio trivia question, but I do understand that WVXU is just across the border from that foreign country of Kentucky. So I thought I'd have a Kentucky-related trivia question.
I do want to point out, I grew up in northern Kentucky, and
I'll talk slow then.
Okay.
Hi, Dan.
Okay, very good.
Sorry. Anyway, we are mourning. Yes. Well, we are mourning John McCain, and he's certainly being mourned in Arizona, where he served in Congress for 35 years. But, of course, he was born in the Panama Canal Zone, and he didn't move to Arizona until the 1980s. Anyway, so a Kentucky trivia question. Who was the last senator born in Kentucky?
The last Kentucky senator?
No, any senator.
Any senator. Yeah. The last Kentucky senator. So, born in Kentucky. If you think you know the answer, call 513-419-7100, and we'll be taking calls and seeing how those line up, and Howard will be thinking and be preoccupied by that one. And by the way, as we go along here, if you have questions for either Ken or Howard at any time during the show, call 513-419-7100 or email us at talk@wvxu.org. We're also on Facebook and Twitter. So let's start with the death and the memorial services this weekend for John McCain. And Ken, you know, what do you think McCain, who apparently took a very personal, intense role in planning all of these services when he knew that he had the diagnosis a year ago, what do you think he was trying to do in laying things out the way he has?
Well, you know, he said that he had no feud with Donald Trump, or said he's not angry at Donald Trump for anything. But it does seem like, given the ugliness and the pettiness of what the two of them were going through, and I blame most of it on Donald Trump, although, to be fair, John McCain at one point said that Donald Trump was unfit to be president, and God forbid you ever accuse Donald Trump or be insulting to Donald Trump. So, and that was followed by Donald Trump saying, well, he's not a hero because heroes, I don't like people who were captured. But while McCain did make life somewhat miserable for Trump over the years, most notably the famous thumbs down vote on the Republican repeal of Obamacare in July of 2017, the fact that Donald Trump has been campaigning, going around rallies lately, mocking John McCain about, Mr. Thumbs Down, he would call him, or Senator Thumbs Down, and mock McCain. Yeah. There was a recent event where Donald Trump spoke at a ceremony honoring John McCain's bill that came out of the Senate Armed Services Committee, and Trump refused to even mention McCain's name. So obviously there was more pettiness on Trump's part than McCain, but McCain didn't forget what was going on. And so as John McCain was making these arrangements for his funeral, which is such a ghoulish prospect, but I guess, you know, it was also realistic, he made it clear that Donald Trump was not welcome at the funeral.
Yeah, he did something else too, which I think was very interesting, and it was sort of a thumb in the eye of Vladimir Putin by asking a Russian dissident by the name of Vladimir Kara-Murza to be a pallbearer at the services at the Capitol. And Kara-Murza was poisoned twice, and nearly died in Russia, and it was very, very clear that it was a KGB-type operation.
And so by choosing him, McCain's making a statement about foreign policy here.
He was making a statement about foreign policy and reiterating the fact that he, when Trump and Putin sat down and spoke, that he thought Trump's behavior was absolutely unforgivable for a U.S.
And remember the fact that Trump invited Putin to come to Washington, D.C.
Yes.
So McCain said, oh, you want to have a Russian in D.C.? I'll show you a Russian.
Yeah.
And he invited this dissident. Exactly.
Exactly. And now he's going to be his pallbearer.
So let's move on to some other topics here. And that one of the things I want to talk about is the negotiations around NAFTA with Mexico and Canada. And supposedly, the president says he wants a deal that can be sent to Congress by tomorrow. Ken, first off, what's driving that timeline and who has the leverage right now?
I don't understand what the timeline is all about. I mean, it was president on his own who decided to upend NAFTA. As a matter of fact, just like the name McCain, and I hope we get back to John McCain because there's a lot I'd like to talk about.
Yeah.
But anyway, just like he won't talk about John McCain, he won't use the word NAFTA as well. And basically, you know, he the president, decided to work out a deal with Mexico. And you talk about who's driving the deal. Well, it's Donald Trump. I mean, he got Mexico to agree. He's pressuring Canada to come on board. Canada, I think, was blindsided by this, the fact that they were on the outs. And apparently they will come on board. I don't understand, of course, why there's a deadline of tomorrow. It just, that I don't understand at all.
And Congress had made it clear to the Trump administration that any rewriting of NAFTA would be a three-way situation.
It couldn't be bilateral.
Bilateral. It had to be Canada, Mexico, and the United States, period.
And, you know, with the agreement of that, the tentative agreement, the outlines of the agreement with Mexico, what is it that the United States has gained from this that would make President Trump, who obviously is happy with what they've come to an agreement with Mexico, what is it that is to the U.S. advantage that we didn't have before?
Howard, I'd love to pass this to you because I really don't know.
I don't know either, Ken. I know what the disadvantage would be if you were to cut, say, Canada out of this deal entirely in a state like Ohio, where one of the major industries is auto parts, making auto parts and sending them to Canada to the tune of over $2 billion a year, that could be very detrimental to the economy in this state, not to mention the agriculture in this state. And I don't see the benefit. I couldn't point to a benefit of just sitting down and working out this deal with Mexico.
But there's clearly, I mean, just like Sherrod Brown is among them as well, there are a lot of Democrats who felt that that NAFTA was not good for American labor, and they had complaints about that from day one. And, of course, NAFTA was passed under President Clinton and endorsed by President Obama. I mean, I don't know if this is part of Trump's desire to just get rid of all things Clinton and all things Obama, but the redrawing of the deal, the remaking of the deal, from what I've seen, I don't see any drastic difference except the fact that this will be a Trump deal. You know, this will be Trump's art of the deal and not part of the Clinton-Obama legacy.
Well, Ken, you know, you said that you had more that you wanted to say about John McCain. I didn't mean to rush this. I'm just aware there are so many things that happen on national politics every day, much less over the course of a month. And we only get to talk to you once a month. What would you like to observe about John McCain?
Well, I mean, he was the kind of guy who just, you know, infuriated everybody who observed him. And I say that because I remember when he came back to the Senate after following his his brain cancer surgery in 2017, and they removed, you know, that huge scar he had on his face of removing a cancerous tumor. And so he gave this very passionate, moving speech about what's wrong with the Senate, and we need regular order, and we need to work across party lines. And so when he gives that speech, everybody on the left, mostly, a lot of Democrats, you know, said, well, I never liked John McCain before, but I love him now. And that was all over social media. And then 2 minutes later, when he votes with the Republicans to continue the debate on the Republican plan to get rid of the Affordable Care Act, these same Democrats said, I hate John McCain, and here's why I hate John McCain. And then 3 days later, when he came to the Senate in the middle of the night, and that dramatic thumbs down vote that basically killed the Republican repeal of Obamacare, the Democrats kept saying, well, you know, now I love this guy after all. So what was amazing about him is that he was infuriating, he was crude, he could be mocking. You know, we always say that about Donald Trump. I think nobody was more of a got into more scraps and battles and in your face than John McCain. But he also apologized when he crossed the line. He also talked to across the line politically with Democrats. He would work with Democrats. He would work with Ted Kennedy. He would work with Joe Lieberman. He would work with Democrats who he felt that would better the country. And two things that stuck out in the one, that very magnanimous concession speech he made after Obama beat him in 2008, where he could have been bitter and angry, and yet he kept saying that we need to work together, and I congratulate him, and I will do everything I can to make the Obama presidency a success. But also that speech in July of 2017, where he said, we're not getting anything done. And when you think of all the things that McCain stood for, you know, a bipartisan foreign policy, perhaps an internationalist foreign policy, and maybe even an aggressive military policy, because he was very supportive of the military and he supported more troops in Iraq and, you know, the surge and all that. But he also supported immigration overhaul and a bipartisan deal to work out agreements on judges. So many of the things, and limiting money in politics, so many of the things that John McCain worked for most of his 35 years in Congress are almost gone. They're either gutted by the president or gutted by the Republican Congress. And I don't, you know, you talk about what a legacy is, and you think of how, you know, you think of like when Ted Kennedy died, you think of all the things he accomplished and all the greatness he accomplished. And I think the same thing with John McCain, too, but it just seems like all the things that he did and Obama did, they seems to be disappearing. And I understand that Donald Trump was elected to reverse the 8 years of Obama. That's what he promised, and that's what he's delivering. But it just seems like when you think of the decency of John McCain and all the lessons learned, you know, he was a hero in Vietnam, and he was chastened by his role in the Keating Five. But he learned something from that, and he learned to be more honest and independent. And yet somehow all that honesty and independence and maverickosity, to make up a word,
yep,
seems to be forgotten, and it could be forgotten very quickly. And that's part of my sadness, I think.
Okay. Before we have to take a break here, I would like
you
to—
Is it 2 o'clock already?
No. Break.
Just
a break.
Did I just talk for 50 minutes nonstop again?
It only seemed that way.
Howard hates that. Howard gets so upset.
Can you?
That's all right. I wrote my column about McCain this week. So.
He did. Okay. And could you repeat the trivia question?
Okay. Well, John McCain, of course, was not born in Arizona, even though he's heralded for the 35 years he spent in Congress in Arizona. Who was the last senator born in Kentucky?
Okay, last senator born in Kentucky. You know the answer to that? Call 513-419-7100. After the Labor Day recess, the Senate will convene hearings on the nomination of Brett Kavanaugh, because these are taking place just weeks before the midterm elections. A number of Democratic senators from red states find themselves in very difficult positions. For some guidance on what to watch for in the next couple of weeks as this rolls out, we are joined today by political junkie Ken Rudin and WVXU politics reporter Howard Wilkinson. And I have to say, at the moment, we still
We're not overwhelmed with answers yet. So, Ken, let's repeat the question one more time.
The last senator of any state, the last senator who was born in Kentucky.
Okay, last senator born in Kentucky. You know the answer to that, 513-419-7100. We do have a call from someone who wants to join in on the discussion that we were having in the first segment. Dan, you have a observation about the timeline on the NAFTA deal.
Yeah, I think that he's actually trying, Trump, of course, is actually trying to push it through before the Mexican presidential election.
So it's the Mexican election that maybe is setting the timeline here.
I've heard people discussing that, and sort of it seems to make sense. I think he's afraid that if you know, whichever way the election goes, this agreement may be dead in the water.
Ken, Howard, anybody want to take that up?
That's as good an explanation as I've heard. Yeah, I mean, it makes sense.
It's. I mean, I didn't know why there was a imperative that he gets it done quickly, and that does make sense.
Yeah, I do say I want to point out, if I understand the situation correctly, it is that election's already taken place. It's a question of when the swearing in is, and the incoming president is also supportive of the change. So it's not that if they don't get it done under the current president, it's blown up. But I'm sure you just want to get that done and feel like you're.
But when
you're
the new one comes in, it's there.
It just feels like to me that this is. I mean, obviously, when Trump worked out this agreement with Mexico. And the Trudeau government in Canada said, well, wait a second, we have a lot of issues that we need to deal with. I think this almost feels, and again, this is just speculation, it almost feels like a bullying tactic, like I want it now, and that's it, and I want you to sign up. And I kind of think that it's putting folks in Canada under tremendous pressure because I mean, they want a deal, they want to be part of this deal, but the fact that this is Trump's timeline and Trump's timeline only, I just don't know. I just feel it's an artificial deadline that Trump has imposed on the Canadian government because he just likes to make Trudeau squirm. But again, that's just, I don't know. I just don't know any other reason why it would be happening.
That's the only explanation.
Okay. Well, let's move on to the hearings that are going to start next week. And I do want to say that when those hearings start on Wednesday, WVXU will cover those hearings live. In what our understanding is, it will be in this time slot. So you'll get to hear those portions of those hearings as they develop. So with the Kavanaugh hearings, what's going to be the Democratic strategy going into next week? You know, what are they going to do to try to slow down, stop, overturn this proposal?
All they can do is just talk and keep asking questions, keep asking the same questions over and over and over again, and try to push this thing back, you know, even beyond the midterm elections, because we don't know what's going to happen then. And there's always, you know, they hold out this hope that they can change the makeup of both the House and the Senate. And it's going to be stall tactics from beginning to end.
And Ken, one of the interesting things about this is that the stall tactics, a lot of those are being pushed on release of certain documents, not on substantive issues that everybody thought or thinks are really at stake in the nomination of Kavanaugh, which is an interesting sort of tactic. It's a procedural tactic.
Well, I think it's more than that. First of all, I remember that when Ruth Bader Ginsburg was going before the Senate, there were Republicans who were demanding, you know, documents she had during her long career. And the fact is, that Brett Kavanaugh does have a long career, not only serving in the George W. Bush administration, but serving as a top aide to Kenneth Starr during the Clinton impeachment hearings. And there was some very embarrassing stuff that was released not too long ago, stuff that Kavanaugh was demanding that they ask of Clinton about personal questions about his sex life and things like that, that almost seems, you know, like beyond the pale. But and so Democrats would love to see some of those documents. There are some on the far left of the Democratic Party who say that who argue that Trump is an illegal president, given the fact that what Manafort and Cohen and others have to say, and therefore he doesn't have the right to appoint a Supreme Court justice, which is nonsense. But to me, it's no more nonsense than the refusal to acknowledge Merrick Garland in 2016. But the fact is that there is a lot of pressure by liberal special interest groups that they would love to delay the hearings. I'm not sure if they want it after the elections, because I suspect that the Republicans could even pick up seats in November.
Yeah,
so there's a lot of pressure on Susan Collins of Maine, who has kind of flipped back and forth. She often talks a good game that she'll stand up to conservatives and reactionaries, and she often goes along. You know how she feels about abortion rights, but she's also said that Kavanaugh has assured her that the Roe decision is stated law and it's not going to change anytime soon. Now, of course, any piece of stated law could change if the Supreme Court wants it to change. So even if there are only 50 Republican senators, let's just say we don't even have an appointment, although I suspect we will. So we'll have 51 Republican in Arizona. So we'll have 51 Republican senators. If nobody breaks from the Republican ranks, then it doesn't matter what Joe Manchin or Joe Donnelly or Heidi Heitkamp do, because they'll have the majority. So Democrats are obviously trying to come up with a smoking gun. I don't know if they'll find it. And again, I don't, you know, it's hard to make the case that they'll stop. But I keep hearing more and more from liberal special interest groups that they are doing everything they can to thwart the nomination. I just don't know how they do it.
Yeah, the numbers don't seem to be there. And the three Democrats that you just mentioned who are in these states that are very supportive of President Trump, the likelihood that they won't break and vote for him, I think, is pretty slim. So anyway, we do now have some answers. And I want to go to Ruben first. Ruben, what is your idea about who was the last Kentucky senator?
Wendell Ford.
Wendell Ford.
Well, Wendell Ford, who was elected senator in 1974, as you well remember, replacing Marlo Cook. He was born in Kentucky, but he's not the most recent.
He's not the most recent. Okay. We also have Paul, who has an idea. Paul?
Yes, Jim Bunning.
Jim Bunning from Northern Kentucky.
Jim Bunning is the correct answer.
All right. Congratulations, Paul.
The reason I like this, I mean, we forget, or some people forget, but Rand Paul, the junior senator from Kentucky, was born in Pittsburgh.
Right.
And Mitch McConnell, the Senate Majority Leader, was born in Alabama. So the senator before that was Jim Bunning, the surly pitcher, and who became a surly senator, a two-term Republican, right?
All right.
Yeah, you didn't want to stand in the box.
No.
Either in the batter's
box or in
the witness box and with Jim Bunning in front of you asking questions.
Exactly. He would throw at your head either time, exactly.
So
I did get this, by the way.
You did? Oh. Yeah. I should have checked. Yes, Howard did get it right. I can vouch for that.
Yes.
He wrote it down early. So staying on this politics and the elections, where do you think the two parties are going? You know, now that all the primaries are gone, where do we stand in terms of the Republicans and the Democrats going into the fall elections, Ken?
Well, I think we're in the same position we were in the beginning of the year, in the fact that the Democrats still have to have a lot of breaks for them to pick up the 23 seats in the House to make Nancy Pelosi speaker. And it may not even be Nancy Pelosi as a speaker, because the Democrats have their own problems. And so I think they have a shot, a good shot of winning the House, not as good as winning the Senate, even though they need three. But I thought the last round of primaries, and by the way, there are still some more states that have primaries, New Hampshire, New York. New York has the gubernatorial primary on September 10th. That's when the governor, Andrew Cuomo, is seeking a third term. But I kind of think that for the most part, I thought it was kind of fascinating what we saw in Florida on Tuesday, because yes. You got a noticeably left-of-center African-American candidate for governor on the Democratic side, Andrew Gillum, who's the mayor of Tallahassee, who has been endorsed by Bernie Sanders and George Soros and you know prominent folks on the left. And then you have Ron DeSantis, who's a very conservative congressman from, I think Daytona, who was endorsed by Donald Trump. He was not supposed to win the primary until Trump endorsed him, and then he crushed his opponent in the primary. And he said something, it was something that he said a day or so ago about that had racial implications. And of course, it's slipping my mind right now.
Well, he said we can't monkey around with this.
Right, you're right. Exactly. We can't monkey around with the Rick Scott, with the progress made by Rick Scott. And a lot of people took that to be a dog whistle, again, because of the fact that Gillum, the Democratic candidate, is African-American. Right. And so, you know, once upon a time, races for governor was about competence and getting things done. And, you know, the famous thing, there's no Democrat or Republican way of taking out the garbage. But it's become very ideological. And Gillum seems to be backed by folks on the far left and DeSantis on the far right. So it puts a lot of people in the middle.
It's one of those races where the choice is pretty darn clear.
It's real clear. And it's pretty amazing, you know, that he came out of this Democratic primary, you know, so strong, really.
He had no money. Gwen Graham, who's the daughter of Bob Graham, the former governor and senator, was heavily favored. But she was a little cautious. She was a little careful. And there were some progressives who said, look, we don't want Republican-light candidates. I mean, Gwen Graham was hardly Republican-light, but she was not a flaming liberal either. And so if we always talk about the divisions within the Republican Party about, you know, the establishment, moderate McCain wing, and the nativist Trump wing, there are divisions on the Democratic side as well between people who ostensibly are trying to win as a moderate, as we saw with Connor Lamb, for example, in Pennsylvania when he won that special House election, and the folks like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, the woman who won the Democratic primary in New York, who is, you know, a self-styled socialist and free medical care for all and
well, I think what you have to do is you have to look at the specific districts that some of these people come out. Howard, you
were... Oh, I agree.
Well, I mean, we had one here in Ohio, you know, just very recently, August 7th, and it just wrapped up last week as far as the official count. In Ohio 12, which is a very Republican, very conservative district in central Ohio. It runs from the suburbs of Columbus down into the foothills of Appalachia. John Kasich represented this district for a long time. Trump was backing Troy Balderson, who was from Zanesville, a state senator. And he ended up winning the race by 1,605 votes. That's less than 1%. That is a district that Donald Trump in 2016 won by 11%. Now, Democrats look at that and they say, maybe we're making progress here. Maybe we can, you know, actually win some of these Trump districts. Now, you know, the other argument says, I don't know, you know, these two same candidates are going to meet in November. The fall, for a full term, and it'll return to the mean, and it'll be back to, you know, a solid Republican district. I don't know; it's too soon to tell. But that one little congressional district in Ohio gave Democrats a whole lot of hope for other districts that are similar to it.
Well, Ken, looking broadly across the United States, I mean, I think everybody agrees that the House is in play.
Yes.
In the Senate, are there races in the Senate where you think a Democrat might upset a incumbent Republican of some significance?
Well, I think the only vulnerable Republican incumbent is in Nevada with Dean Heller. It's the only state where a Republican is running for re-election, in a state that Hillary Clinton captured in 2016. So that's one to watch. Another one to watch absolutely is in Arizona, and we saw the results of the primaries of that on Tuesday as well, where Kyrsten Sinema, who's a centrist Democrat, represents a district in Congress. She's the Democratic nominee, and Martha McSally, who once upon a time was an establishment moderate Republican until she realized when she's challenged by Joe Arpaio and Kelly Ward that she had to move further to the right. So she moved way to the right, embraced Donald Trump, didn't even mention John McCain's name, and won the Republican primary quite handily. It is a seat, theoretically, that the Democrats could win, even though they haven't won a Senate seat since 1988 in Arizona. But Sinema is basically has wide support on the Democratic side. The Republican vote is still split. John McCain, for all everything you think about him, John McCain and Jeff Flake, the two senators, former senators in Arizona, they are not beloved, shall we say, by fellow Republicans. The party has moved towards Trump land, and the question is whether McSally can unite the party in time to hold on to the seat in November. That's why the person who Doug Ducey picks to succeed John McCain is going to be very important, too, because if the party is alienated, if one side is feeling that it's being preferred over the other, a lot of Republicans could sit home in November, and that could doom them. So I think between Nevada and Arizona and perhaps Tennessee, where Bob Corker is retiring, and the Democratic nominee there is a former governor by the name of Phil Bredesen, those seem to be the only three seats where the Democrats could pick up seats in November, and there are a lot of vulnerable Democrats.
Right. So swinging the Senate to Democrats seems not very likely. Yesterday, the White House counsel, Don McGahn, was fired via tweet. As important as that in itself was, it also raises questions about what's happening inside the White House in terms of preparing for a potential takeover of the House of Representatives by the Democrats this fall. To discuss this and other issues, we are joined today by political junkie Ken Rudin and WVXU politics reporter Howard Wilkinson. If you'd like to join the conversation, please call us at 513-419-7100 or email us at talk@wvxu.org. So this announcement yesterday, announcement, firing, whatever it is, of the White House counsel, what does this tell us about what's happening inside the White House, Ken?
Well, it's clear that the president does not like anybody who is not behind him 1,000%. And clearly, Don McGahn, the fact that the White House counsel, who has said, look, I am not Donald Trump's lawyer. I am the lawyer to the office of the president. And so he deserves some credit for that. And McGahn in the past has stood up to Trump. Like when Trump wanted to fire James Comey, the head of the FBI, McGahn said no. When Trump said to McGahn that we should get rid of Robert Mueller, he said no. And he's threatened to resign. So he has stood up to him. But the fact is that McGahn has spent 30 hours testifying before the Mueller investigation team. And even though Trump says, you know, I approve of that, and that's not the reason I sent out the tweet, that sounds kind of silly to me. I mean, obviously, they don't trust McGahn. He's somebody who doesn't see eye to eye with Trump on all these things. And the danger of that is that you don't have somebody who's left anymore who could warn him, the president, of potential legal dangers. I mean, Rudy Giuliani, whatever Trump says or whatever he sees on Fox and Friends, he'll go on Fox and say, this is reality. And, I mean, he'll say that truth isn't truth. And it's like the alternative facts we heard from Kellyanne Conway a while back. So McGahn was one of those straight shooters in the White House. He was very instrumental in getting many conservatives appointed to the judiciary, appointed and confirmed to the judiciary around the country. He did a great job. He was a clear conservative, and he was also shepherding the Brett Kavanaugh Supreme Court nomination. So he's not that he's John Dean or anything. He's not conspiring against the president, but he's a straight shooter, and apparently that's not what the president wants.
Well, Howard, you know, it's not just John McGahn from what is being reported.
Mm-hmm.
The White House counsel office,
yeah,
which normally has 35 people, is down to 25. After tomorrow, there'll only be one assistant White House counsel at that level.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's a lot of question whether the president grasps just how serious the situation may be.
I think there's a lot of concern of people who are basically political allies of Donald Trump who are worried that he doesn't understand what the situation is, particularly, say, if in November the Democrats take control of the House and what that could mean for him. What it can mean, there's obvious things that it can mean for his legislative agenda because they could wreak all kinds of havoc on that. And then also that possibility lurking out there of impeachment. And, you know,
even if the Republicans hold on to the Senate, which means he wouldn't be convicted
in all likelihood not convicted. But it would be a very uncomfortable position for him to be in if the Democrats end up in charge of the House. And there's a fear among some of his friends, the ones that he hasn't fired yet, that he doesn't understand what the situation is. Yeah. He really doesn't.
Howard, Ken, a couple days ago at a White House dinner for Christian evangelicals, the president warned that if the Democrats take control he didn't say House or Senate, but if they take control in November, I quote, they will overturn everything we've done and they'll do it quickly and violently. You know, what is that signal? What's a sentence like that signal?
Well, he's right about the first part. The first part is clear that if the Democrats do take control of the House, and I think he was talking about the House, there will be investigations. There will not be Devin Nunes, you know, running things by blocking everything that's critical of Trump. There will, and I suspect that they could even be, depending on what Mueller has to say, but there could be votes on whether there's obstruction of justice and things like that. But the fact that he's talking about that if the Democrats, they can do it violently, it's very interesting. First of all, we've seen at rallies, at campaign rallies by Donald Trump, he's actually almost encouraged violence by his own supporters. But when you start worrying, when you start equating the two sides in Charlottesville and talking about that the left is just as equal, is equally as dangerous as the Nazis, and in some ways he did that, and then to suggest that Democratic control of the House will lead to them taking violent actions against Republicans. Look, obviously he's trying to excite his base, excite the Fox crowd, by saying that you can't let this happen. And you know something, what I think is very interesting about all this is that on the day of the Manafort Manafort convicted on 8 counts of tax fraud and bank issues, and when Michael Cohen pleaded guilty, you say, oh my goodness, this sounds almost like Watergate in scope. The polls that came out right after that, Trump's numbers didn't move at all. The Republicans certainly didn't back away from him. His numbers didn't sink. Democratic numbers didn't move up for November. So when he starts threatening about violence and what the Democrats are going to do, I think that it's people, his supporters are taking it to heart. And so that's why I'm not convinced. what's going to happen in November. Everybody says there's a blue wave coming up. I'm not convinced of that. I kind of think that it's very possible that Democrats could be so discouraged by what's going on and everything, they theoretically could sit home and while the angry Trump supporters come out to vote. I don't know what's going to happen, but clearly he knows that there's a potential for disaster for everything he's trying to do, and he's trying to excite his voters to make sure that doesn't happen.
I think in the end it's going to be a matter of which side is the angriest, because he's making the Democrats very angry too and doing things that are motivating them to go out and work for, you know, congressional candidates and that sort of thing.
Howard, another part of this McGahn announcement is that McGahn also stood up at certain points on the question of getting – Trump obviously is very unhappy with Attorney General Jeff Sessions. Mm-hmm. Lots of talk in recent days that waiting until after the primary after the midterms and then maybe Sessions would be fired, which then exposes Rob Rosenstein and then exposes Mueller. What do you see happening here, and where are the breaks on any of that?
That's a real good question. I'm not sure there are any breaks on that. You know, we all can, of a certain age, we can remember October 1973 when Nixon ordered Elliot Richardson, the attorney general, to get rid of Archibald Cox. He wouldn't do it. He would not do it. Neither would his deputy, William Ruckelshaus. And they had to go down the line and find the solicitor general, Robert Bork, who finally said, well, somebody's got to carry out the orders of the president. And he did it. I'm not sure there are many... Well, there aren't any Elliot Richardsons left. There aren't any William Ruckelshauses left. There's just nobody to stand up and say no.
And there are a lot of Robert Borks left, and that's the scary part.
Right.
And if you think of what Lindsey Graham said in the Senate yesterday, which I think is very, very interesting. I don't know if he said it in the Senate, but he said this yesterday. Once upon a time, Lindsey Graham was somebody who would stand up to Donald Trump and talk about his excesses. And he was John McCain's best friend in the Senate. But I don't know if playing golf with Trump has changed his mind a lot. But he basically said that I see no problem with getting rid of, I mean, he didn't say this in so many words, but I see no problem in getting rid of the Attorney General, Jeff Sessions, because Donald Trump deserves an Attorney General he can get along with. Now, in fairness, that's true. You want the president to have an Attorney General he can work with. But basically, if Lindsey Graham is giving the president carte blanche to fire the Attorney General or do anything he can to dump him, it just shows that more and more Republicans are not worried about what Howard talked about, a Saturday night massacre or any kind of massacre where the law enforcement officers of this country are shunted aside in favor of Trump loyalists.
Well, all of that's going to keep evolving. I want to take a few minutes here at the end of the show, talk a little bit about foreign policy. President Trump, a week ago, 10 days ago, stopped the Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo, from going to North Korea to continue negotiations on denuclearization, said that it wasn't worth going, pulled the plug on the trip at the last moment. And, where do we stand with – I mean, this was the centerpiece in the early summer of foreign policy, of reaching out to North Korea, Kim Jong-un, developing a relationship and building on that. Where do we stand with that? Howard, any
– I don't know. I mean, I would think that the president of South Korea is rather confused right now about what the situation is. And, he and his people have more at stake here than just about anybody. Mm-hmm. And, I don't know what kind of answers that the Trump administration are giving to them, because surely they've asked.
And the president of South Korea, Moon Jae-in,
Yeah.
He has a trip to North Korea scheduled
right.
in September.
Exactly,
so
yeah.
a lot riding on that. He could end up being the person who is the go-between.
Right.
Or he could end up really losing the faith of his constituency. Ken, what's your view on our situation with North Korea?
It is so the president's foreign policy has been so impulsive from the beginning. Remember, Kim Jong-un was the little rocket man who, and they were going to launch missiles and blow them to kingdom come, a war that, you know, that nobody's ever seen before. And then he's their best buddies. They're now Facebook friends. I think on Kim's Facebook page, it says the relationship, it's complicated. Because, I mean, his palship with Trump is just all over the map. When Trump decided unilaterally to cancel the joint military exercises with South Korea, that threw everybody out of whack. It was not expected. And now Trump suddenly is saying that it's not working, and I'm blaming China for this all. So what he did with Mike Pompeo about pulling him back is exactly what he did to Rex Tillerson when Tillerson was in Beijing, working out a deal, and Trump said, forget it, the diplomacy is not going to work. It just seems like we're doing foreign policy by gut reaction and whatever suits him at the moment, and there's no rhyme or reason to explain what he's doing.
What do you think the United States is even willing to put on the table in order to move this forward towards real denuclearization?
Go ahead, Ken.
I was just going to say that. I mean, the one thing North Korea was demanding for the longest time was the cessation of military exercises with the South.
Right.
So Trump said, fine, I'll do that. And yet North Korea showed no interest in slowing down the enrichment of uranium. And so they were still looking at building missiles. And I think somehow when Donald Trump is so confident of his own abilities, you know, the art of the deal, and if it doesn't happen right away, as we're seeing with NAFTA now, if it doesn't happen right away, he says, well, you know, okay, forget it. I'm picking up my marbles and going home. And that's what it sounds like he's doing with North Korea.
Is the possibility of a peace treaty rather than an armistice even realistic? And what would it mean?
What is the possibility, and Donald Trump in the same sentence?
Right.
So that's it.
There's no answering that question.
Just trying to ask questions that I think are logical.
Logical, yes.
I'm sort of stuck. Yeah. So I want to thank. Go ahead, Ken.
Ohio 12 made much more sense than what's going on in North Korea, can we say.
Okay. I want to thank Ken Rudin and Howard Wilkinson for being here today. You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7. The producer for today's show is Pete Reitmeier. The assistant producer is Selena Reeder. Segment producer is Layla Shakui. The technical director is Josh Elstro. Archives of our program are available on the website, wvxu.org. I'm Dan Hurley. Stay tuned for Here and Now, coming up next.